Welcome back, everybody. Ready for another deep dive?
I am always ready to dig into some fascinating research.
And we've got a really thought-provoking one today.
Oh, yeah. This one really gets you thinking about whether policies designed to help farmers and the environment, well, could they actually be doing more harm than good?
That is the central question here. And it all revolves around this thing called the Common Agricultural Policy.
The CAP.
CAP, yep, that's the one. I'm guessing some of our listeners might not be totally familiar with that.
Yeah, not everyone's up on EU agricultural policy. Makes sense. But in a nutshell, it's this system the EU has for supporting farmers, often through these subsidies.
With the goal of, like, boosting food production.
Right. And at the same time, protecting the environment.
So, you know, good intentions all around.
Seems like a win-win, right?
Totally.
Well, this study, it kind of throws a wrench in things.
Ah.
Yeah, it looks specifically at these areas called Natura 2000 sites.
Natura 2000 sites.
Mm-hmm. They're all over Europe, these protected areas, meant to, you know, safeguard biodiversity.
So picture this, right? We've got these beautiful Natura 2000 sites, lush meadows, sparkling rivers, all teeming with life. And the EU, they want to protect these areas. Makes sense.
Totally.
And of course, farmers need support, so the CIP steps in. But then we get to the big what if of this whole thing.
What if the way that CIP is supporting those farmers is actually clashing with all those conservation efforts?
Oh, yeah. That's where things get interesting.
And that's exactly what this study is trying to figure out.
So where do they take us for this investigation?
To the island of Gotland in Sweden.
Gotland, okay.
Known for its unique alkaline fens.
Alkaline fens.
Yeah. Picture, like, wetlands with fluctuating water levels, you know, sometimes dry, sometimes flooded.
Interesting.
Creates a really unique habitat for all sorts of species.
And one of those species is?
The marsh fritillary butterfly.
Our star of the show, or at least one of them.
Yeah, it's definitely at the heart of this whole investigation.
All right, so we've got our players. Protected areas, farming policy meant to help, and this fragile butterfly population. What exactly did the researchers do to figure out what's going on?
They zeroed in on the impact of grazing.
Grazing.
Mm-hmm, which is pretty common in these Natura 2000 sites, often encouraged by CAP subsidies, actually.
Okay.
And they tracked butterfly populations in both grazed and ungrazed areas over 2 years.
So it's like, let's see what happens when nature does its thing versus when you've got cows or sheep munching away. Makes sense.
Makes sense, yep. And the results, well.
Uh-oh, I'm sensing some bad news here.
Ungrazed areas, the butterfly populations, they were thriving.
Okay, that's good.
But the grazed areas, different story. Significantly fewer butterflies. And that was especially true after this drought that hit in 2019.
Oh, rough year for our butterfly friends.
Yeah. It's like grazing led to a fourfold reduction in habitat quality in a normal year.
Mm.
But then after that drought, boom, it jumps to a 50-fold reduction.
Whoa, that is a massive difference. Safe to say grazing is having a pretty serious impact on the marsh fritillary's survival, especially when things get tough.
Especially when things get tough, yeah.
But it wasn't just the butterflies struggling, was it?
No, the researchers took a look at the plants, too.
And I'm guessing they saw some similar trends.
Definitely. The ungrazed areas, they were bursting with these flowering plants, all providing nectar for those butterflies.
So more food for everyone when there aren't as many mouths to feed?
Right. In fact, they found almost 7 times more flowering plants in those ungrazed areas compared to the grazed ones.
Wow. That is a lot of flowers. But you mentioned orchids before.
Right. Orchids.
Those are often seen as a sign of, like, a healthy ecosystem, aren't they?
Exactly.
What was the story with those?
Well, the difference between the grazed and ungrazed areas, it was pretty staggering.
Okay.
Ungrazed areas had a whopping 12 times higher orchid density.
12 times. That is not a small difference. So it's not just the butterflies taking a hit. It seems like grazing is impacting the whole ecosystem, right down to the plants that support all sorts of species.
Exactly. It's all connected.
Okay, so we've talked about protected areas. We've talked about farming. We've seen the impact on butterflies and plants. Where does the CAP actually fit into all of this?
Well, here's the thing. The researchers discovered that a huge chunk, like 97% of the grazed marsh fritillary habitat, it all falls within those Natura 2000 protected areas.
Oh.
And remember, CAP grazing, it's a dominant management strategy in many of these sites.
Wait, so the very policy that's designed to protect these areas could actually be contributing to the decline of the species it's meant to help.
Yeah, it's a bit of a head scratcher.
It highlights this tricky reality, right? That sometimes our best intentions can have unintended consequences.
Absolutely. And being aware of those consequences, that's crucial.
It seems like we've stumbled onto a real dilemma here. We want to support farmers, we want to protect nature, but what if the way we're going about it is actually causing harm?
It's like putting a Band-Aid on a bullet wound.
Right. Yeah. That's a great way to put it.
It raises all these questions about how we approach agricultural policy. How do we find that balance? You know, where we're meeting human needs, but also the needs of the environment.
For sure. This study is definitely a wake-up call. We need to be looking at the bigger picture here.
We do. And the solutions, well, that's where things get really interesting.
Let's dive into those then. What can we actually do about all of this?
Yeah, it's a tough one for sure. We can't just, like, tell farmers to stop grazing altogether, can we?
Right, exactly. We're not, you know, trying to vilify farmers here.
Yeah, not at all.
Or, like, demonize the CAP or anything. It's more about understanding where things might be going wrong and how we can make them work better.
For sure.
For everyone, you know? The farmers, the butterflies, those orchids, all of it.
Yeah, finding that sweet spot.
The researchers did offer some potential solutions, though. Mm. Didn't they talk about, like, less intense grazing? I'm curious what that actually looks like on the ground.
So less intense grazing, it could involve a few things. Think of it as, like, fine-tuning how grazing is done.
Okay.
Farmers could, for instance, reduce the number of animals grazing in a certain area.
Makes sense.
Or maybe they implement, you know, a rotational grazing system where the livestock are moved between different pastures.
So that gives the land a chance to, like, recover a bit.
Exactly.
So we're not eliminating grazing entirely,
right,
but we're making it more compatible with the needs of the ecosystem.
Yeah, it's like finding a rhythm that works for both the farmers and the butterflies, you know.
I like that, finding the rhythm. That makes sense.
And in some areas, like really sensitive areas, it might even be necessary to completely exclude grazing.
Okay.
At least for certain periods.
So kind of like a timeout for the land.
Yeah, basically. It's about tailoring the approach to what that specific environment needs and, of course, what the species that live there need.
Right. That makes a lot of sense. Now, there was another thing the researchers suggested, and I'll be honest, I'm not totally clear on this one.
Oh, what is it?
They talked about restoring the natural hydrology of these fens.
Ah, yeah.
Can you break that down for me? What does that actually mean?
So remember how we talked about Gotland's alkaline fens?
Yeah, those wetlands with the fluctuating water levels.
Right. That's really key to the unique biodiversity there.
Okay.
But over time, you know, with all sorts of human activities, things like digging ditches for drainage and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's actually altered the natural flow of water in a lot of areas.
So it's like we've messed with the natural ebb and flow.
Yeah, basically. And restoring the hydrology, it means going back and kind of undoing some of those alterations.
Mm-hmm.
Think of it like removing a dam.
And letting the river flow naturally again.
Exactly. So you're mimicking natural processes to create the right conditions, the conditions that favor the species that have evolved to live in those environments, you know.
Like the marsh fritillary.
Yep. Exactly.
Yeah.
The marsh fritillary.
Okay. So we've got less intense grazing, restoring natural water flow. Those sound like promising avenues.
I think so.
But, I mean, let's be real. Changing agricultural practices, changing policies, it's a huge undertaking.
It is.
What are, like, the biggest hurdles we're facing here?
I think one of the biggest challenges is the economic side of things.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of farmers, they rely on those CCAP subsidies to make ends meet.
Right.
And any changes to those subsidies, well, it has to be done carefully so we don't end up hurting farmers financially.
That's a really good point. We can't lose sight of the livelihoods that depend on these policies.
We can't.
Now, the researchers did emphasize the need for flexibility within the CIP, right?
They did.
What did they have in mind with that?
Well, they basically suggested that we got to find ways to support farmers, mm-hmm, while at the same time encouraging practices that are better for biodiversity.
Gotcha. So it's not an either-or situation.
No, not at all.
It's finding that balance.
Exactly. Maybe it looks like offering payments for, you know, specific conservation actions that farmers take.
Okay.
Or maybe it's about providing technical assistance to help them transition to new approaches.
So it's kind of shifting the incentives.
Right.
Instead of just supporting, you know, agricultural production, we're supporting a more holistic approach.
A more holistic approach, yeah.
One that values the environment and biodiversity.
For sure. And there are real world examples where this kind of approach has worked, you know.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Some countries have implemented these things called agri-environmental schemes. Basically, farmers get paid for doing things that benefit the environment.
Interesting.
Things like planting hedgerows.
Okay.
Or creating wildflower meadows, or maybe reducing pesticide use.
I like that.
And these schemes, they've actually shown that we can create these win-win situations, you know?
Where farmers are like rewarded for doing things that are good for both their bottom line and the environment.
Exactly. It is possible.
That's really encouraging to hear. It seems like we've got some good models to work with.
We do.
Now, you also mentioned payments for ecosystem services as another potential solution.
Right. Payments for ecosystem services.
Can you unpack that one a bit for me?
So imagine like a program where landowners actually get compensated for managing their land in a way that provides benefits for everyone.
Benefits for everyone.
Yeah, things like clean water or carbon sequestration or even wildlife habitat.
Interesting.
So you're basically recognizing that, hey, natural resources have value.
Mm-hmm.
And the people who are helping to protect those resources, they should be rewarded.
So it's not just about what we take from the land.
No.
It's also about what the land gives us when it's healthy.
Right. It's a shift in perspective, you know, looking at the bigger picture.
And that shift in perspective needs to be reflected in our policies, right?
Yeah, absolutely. We need to find ways to align those economic incentives with ecological sustainability.
So it's almost like rewiring the system in a way.
It is. Making conservation a natural part of the equation.
I like that. I'm starting to feel a little bit more optimistic about all of this. It sounds like there are solutions out there.
There are.
And we even have some examples of what actually works.
We do.
But I do have one more question about something the researchers mentioned. They emphasize the importance of allowing areas to remain ungrazed for longer periods.
Oh, yeah. That's a good one.
Why is that so important, especially for, you know, our butterfly friend?
So remember how the marsh fritillary caterpillar, it relies on that specific plant, the devil's bit scabious?
For food.
Right, for food. Well, if you have really intense grazing, it can wipe out those plants.
Oh, before the caterpillars have a chance to eat them.
Exactly. So by giving those areas a break from grazing, you're giving the plants a chance to, you know, to come back.
To recover.
Right, to recover and provide more food for the caterpillars down the line.
Makes sense. But it's not just the food, is it?
No, not just the food.
Hmm.
Grazing can also damage those little microhabitats that the caterpillars and pupa need.
For shelter and stuff.
Yeah, exactly. Especially during the winter.
Gotcha.
And disturbing the soil, you know, through all that grazing activity,
mm-hmm.
it can make it harder for the butterflies to lay their eggs.
And for the eggs to hatch.
Exactly. It's like you're disrupting this really delicate balance that they need to thrive.
So allowing areas to rest from grazing, it's basically about creating a more stable environment for the whole life cycle of the butterfly.
For the whole life cycle, yeah.
And I imagine this goes beyond just the marsh fritillary.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah.
Giving ecosystems a chance to recover from grazing, it can benefit all kinds of species.
Okay.
It allows those natural processes to happen.
Processes like?
Well, things like the gradual changes in plant communities over time.
Mm-hmm.
Or the cycling of nutrients and stuff,
mm-hmm.
they can happen without being interrupted.
I see.
And ultimately, it creates a more diverse and resilient ecosystem.
It's interesting how we often view grazing as this like natural part of the landscape, right?
We do.
But this study really shows how even practices that seem natural, they can have unintended consequences.
Yeah, if we're not careful about how we manage them.
Right, we have to respect that delicate balance.
We do. And there are examples of where reducing grazing or maybe strategically excluding it
has led to positive outcomes.
Yeah, positive outcomes for biodiversity in other parts of the world too, not just Gotland.
Okay, can you give us an example?
Sure. One that comes to mind is the grasslands of North America.
Okay.
And the reintroduction of bison there.
Bison, wow. That's interesting.
They've had incredible effects on ecosystem health.
So bison are grazers.
They are. Big grazers, yeah.
But it's not as simple as just, you know, bison equal bad for the environment.
No, not at all. It's about how they graze, mm-hmm. you know? They create this, like, this patchwork of grazed and ungrazed areas as they move around.
So it's not just about keeping grazers out altogether.
No, not at all. It's more about, like, mimicking those natural rhythms, you know?
Okay.
And with bison, that natural grazing pattern...
Mm-hmm.
It actually helps to create a greater diversity of plants.
So more variety.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And that means more different types of habitats, which is a good thing for, well, for a whole bunch of different species.
That's shaking up a kaleidoscope, right? You get all these new patterns.
Yeah, I like that analogy. And this approach, it's not limited to bison either.
Oh.
We can use these same principles to manage grazing with other livestock too.
So creating that mosaic of grazed and ungrazed areas.
Right, yeah, exactly.
To help support biodiversity.
Exactly.
This has been a really eye-opening conversation.
It has.
But as we're talking about all these potential solutions, you know, I keep coming back to that human element.
The human element, for sure.
How do we actually get farmers on board with making these changes? These are their livelihoods we're talking about.
Yeah, that's such a crucial point. And I think, you know, we can't just come in and impose these changes from the top down.
Right.
It has to be a collaborative process.
So working with farmers, not against them.
Exactly. Building that trust.
Finding solutions together.
Right.
Instead of just dictating what they should be doing.
Yeah. And, you know, we got to recognize the incredible knowledge and experience that farmers have.
Oh, for sure.
They're the ones working with the land every single day.
Day in, day out.
Yeah. They understand the nuances of their local ecosystem.
Makes sense to tap into that.
It does.
But I imagine it's not always easy to change, like, deeply ingrained practices and, you know, mindsets. Are there any examples, though, of where this kind of collaborative approach has actually worked? Success stories?
There are, yeah. There are definitely some bright spots out there.
Oh, good.
One promising model is, it's called result-based payments for conservation.
Result-based payments.
So basically, instead of being paid for following specific practices, farmers are rewarded for achieving measurable outcomes.
So it's like, show us the results.
Yeah.
Show us the results.
No, so the
more birds, cleaner water, and you'll be compensated.
Exactly.
That seems a lot more flexible.
It is. And it's more outcome-oriented.
I like it.
And it probably helps to foster a greater sense of ownership among farmers, too, right?
Oh, yeah.
They're not just following rules. They're actively working towards a shared goal.
It's a partnership.
It is, yeah.
Yeah.
A partnership, not just compliance.
That's a good distinction. This is all very hopeful, but I do wonder, how do we actually take these ideas and turn them into concrete policy changes?
That's the million-dollar question, isn't it?
It is. How do we make sure something like the EKIP actually reflects this more holistic, collaborative approach that we've been talking about?
I think it requires a multifaceted strategy.
Okay.
First and foremost, our policies, they need to be based on solid scientific evidence.
So no more shooting in the dark.
No more shooting in the dark. We need that data.
Need data to light the way.
Exactly. And we need policies that are, you know, flexible and adaptable.
Just the world's constantly changing.
Oh, it is.
Yeah.
And agricultural systems need to be able to change with it.
So no more one-size-fits-all approaches?
No, those just don't work.
We need to be able to experiment and adapt to different situations.
Right.
And lastly.
Lastly, our policies need to be inclusive.
Okay.
We need to bring everyone to the table.
Everyone.
Farmers, scientists, policymakers, even consumers.
Wow, that's a lot of people.
It is. But we need to create a shared vision for a sustainable future.
I love that. It's like breaking down those silos, realizing that we're all in this together.
We are. The fate of the marsh fritillary, the health of our ecosystems, it's all connected to our own well-being.
It really is.
It's time to move beyond that us versus them mentality and embrace something more holistic.
I think you're right. Well, this deep dive has certainly given us a lot to think about.
It has.
As we wrap up here, what are some key takeaways you hope our listeners will, you know, kind of mull over as they continue exploring these issues?
I hope they'll walk away with a few things. First, even policies that come from good intentions, they can have negative consequences if we're not careful.
So those good intentions, they're not enough.
Nope. We need to constantly be evaluating our approaches and be willing to adapt based on, you know, on the latest evidence.
So course correcting when things aren't working.
Exactly. Hmm. Second, there's no magic bullet, no single solution for achieving sustainable agriculture.
It's going to take a lot of different approaches.
It is. We need a diversity of solutions that are tailored to, you know, specific contexts.
So embracing that flexibility and innovation.
Right. Finding what works best in each unique situation.
Makes sense. And finally.
Finally, and this is a big one, collaboration is key.
Collaboration.
We need to work together, respect diverse perspectives and, you know, the knowledge that everyone brings to the table.
To ultimately create a future where both people and nature can thrive.
Exactly.
That's a great message to end on. To our listeners, thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive into the complex world of agricultural policy and conservation.
Yeah, thanks for listening.
We hope it sparked your curiosity and inspired you to keep asking those questions.
Keep exploring. Keep learning.
Keep engaging in these crucial conversations.
We all have a role to play.
We do. In shaping a more sustainable future for everyone.
That's right.
Until next time, happy deep diving.